I wanted to talk about women's experience in war, the experience of women soldiers, which is a story that isn't told all that often, but that's gotten some media attention. A little bit about Iraqi women's experience, and then the experience of women here in the United States. And then I hope that we'll have a chance for some really good dialogue and conversation, especially now that it's Women's History Month, and also as we've just passed the second anniversary of the war, as we're looking towards another year of war in Iraq, and we saw this real, I thought, coming from New York and being part of the organizing there, really beautiful and powerful witnesses against war, but the need to sort of sustain all of that for the next decade or however long this war is going to rule on. So Congress designated Women's History Month as March in 1978, but I think we need to do more in this month than sort of learn who the first women astronaut was or the first woman president, but to really celebrate and pay attention to women's impact on the history that's lived by us all, and sort of recognize that the roots of Women's History Month are really in anti-war movements, in the uprising of women throughout history against wars that are perpetrated by men. So I thought that to honor Women's History Month and to mark this second anniversary of the war, I wanted to talk about these sort of three different experiences of soldiers in Iraq, of women, Iraqi women, and then of women here. So there are more than 15,000 American soldiers who are women in Iraq. They make up 10% of our sort of soldier force there. And during the first year of the war in Iraq, in 2003, 16 women were killed in Iraq. And when the 16th died, she was a 41-year-old woman. Her name was Gussie Jones, and she died not in combat, but of a heart attack, actually. We reached a sort of new record for the number of women killed in war. We passed, for the first time, the number of deaths for any war since World War II. She died in March of last year. And since then, the number of women fatalities has increased to 34 in the war in Iraq. In the first Gulf War, 15 women soldiers were killed, 8 service women were killed in Vietnam, and 2 were killed in Korea. During World War II, 432 American women were killed throughout that war. But U.S. involvement in World War II lasted more than 6 years overall. There were more than 15 million American troops who fought in that war, and almost 140,000 fatalities. So the cost there, both overall and in terms of women, were much larger. But as we look towards a sort of long-term occupation, military occupation in Iraq, we have to ask the question, is women's fatality rate going to rise to the level of World War II? It seems kind of hard to imagine, but we're really just looking at the very beginning of U.S. military involvement in Iraq, despite the much that has been made of sort of U.S. Configured, U.S.-led, U.S. sort of created elections that happened there in January. U.S. analysts estimate that there will be an American military presence in Iraq for at least 10 years, and that's sort of the quiet words coming out of the White House. And then we have more independent analysts saying that we're building permanent military bases throughout Iraq, and that we plan on being there for good, essentially. And what we see in Iraq is that women's role is changing. Women's role in the military is changing. There was a report in the Australian newspaper, The Age, and I actually haven't seen this report in American newspapers, that the U.S. Army is considering repealing a rule that prohibits women from being on the front line in combat situations. And so they're sort of quietly going through the process of changing this rule. But even before the rule officially changes and women are officially on the front lines, There are women soldiers in combat every day in Iraq. There was an article in the Chicago Tribune not too long ago that quotes a tank driver, a woman tank driver, and she says, well, I'm not technically in combat, as she's driving this tank through down a road that's mined by insurgent bombs all the time. And the other thing to remember in Iraq is that there is no front line in Iraq. There is no safe place behind which women can perform sort of auxiliary roles there. That the entire country is a front line because of the nature of the war there. There's a 24/7 insurgency, there's urban combat, there's all of these different groups that really see the U.S. military as the target. And that puts women de facto in new positions while the army is sort of catching up. One of the reasons that the army wants to change this rule is that there aren't enough soldiers overall. We're seeing lots of ways in which the military is trying to hold on to the soldiers that it has. There's an article in the paper today that the army wants to change its requirements in for older soldiers to come in. So I think they're raising the you know, you can't be younger than 18 or older than 39 or something like that. And they're raising that now to bring in older soldiers because there aren't enough volunteers to fight this war. So 34 women soldiers have been killed in Iraq, and many, many more have been wounded. For every one soldier killed, 7 are wounded. So while the wounded figures aren't divided by sex, possible to say that there are, of the 1,500 soldiers who have been killed, there's another 11,000 wounded soldiers, and that 1,500 of those have been women. Now, while women are in uniform in Iraq and fighting there, Iraqi insurgents and foreign terrorists and roadside bombs are not the only threats to American service women. And in an alarming number of instances, their male peers and superiors are their enemies. There's a report that was actually done by the Pentagon called the Sexual Assault Task Force that found that in the first 18 months of the war and occupation in Iraq, there were more than 100 instances of rape and sexual assault and other forms of sexual misconduct that were perpetrated against service women by male colleagues in the military. And this is what was reported. And we know here in this country that only about 16% of rapes are reported to the police. So we can assume in this very sort of stratified and rigid sort of hierarchy that is the military that, well, 100 instances of this sort of violence sounds like a lot. It's also drastically underreported. Overall, sexual trauma has reached epidemic proportions for women in the military, with numbers twice as high as those amongst the civilian population. And again, that's according to this Department of Defense study that was done in 2003. There's one story of an Army lieutenant who was raped by a non-commissioned officer in Kuwait right before combat started in Iraq. And she said afterwards, "I didn't feel safe in Iraq, not because I was in a war zone, but because of him." And how she was treated by her superiors afterwards is almost as bad as what she experienced during the assault. When she regained consciousness after the attack, she was transported to another facility. She was interrogated for 3 hours, and then she was left in isolation for an extended period of time. Her request for religious counseling, for someone to talk to, were repeatedly denied. And this is common. This is what happens, basically. Despite the gruesome regularity of these sorts of attacks, the military has no protocol for dealing with sexual assault, despite the fact that 15% of soldiers in uniform in Iraq are women. Many of the victims do not even receive the most basic medical care, emergency contraception, evidence kits that would help prosecute the perpetrator, testing for sexually transmitted diseases, testing for HIV, and rape crisis counseling are not consistently available. In addition, military personnel lack even the most common sense sort of sensitivity to how to respond to this kind of trauma. There was one report of a mental health counselor who sent an Army sergeant who had just been raped back out onto missions, back with her crew, out on missions in Baghdad again, because he thought, oh, it would be good for her to keep busy, keep her mind off of what had just happened. Prosecution of these crimes is delayed indefinitely. Servicewomen are waiting, they often continue to serve in the same units with the perpetrator, sometimes even sleep in the same barracks again with their assailant. So even as women are shouldering the same burdens and taking the same risks in Iraq, they're not being treated the same. They're not being accorded the basic sort of human decency and rights. In the case that I mentioned earlier, the women's attacker, when it was found that he was responsible for this, was given a non-judicial punishment, and he received a small pay cut as a result. The woman, on the other hand, became depressed. She overdosed on pain medication. She tried to commit suicide. She was shipped back home and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. This is all before she even went into the combat zone. So the PTSD was all from the rape and then how she was treated afterwards. She says, now everyone turned their backs on me. I have lost everything. Turning now to look at the experience of Iraqi women, if you think that female American soldiers feel under attack in Iraq, imagine what Iraqi women are experiencing. Their country's been destroyed, their families torn apart, and their entire way of life completely shattered. Well, in Europe a few weeks ago, at the beginning of March, when I was supposed to come here the first time, President Bush hailed the 2005, the January elections as Iraq's purple revolution. For the purple ink that was used to mark the fingers of voters, and for those iconic pictures of veiled women displaying their inked fingers. He even brought an Iraqi woman who had voted, still had the purple ink on her finger, to the State of the Union, and he talked about her during the State of the Union. But while Bush asserts that every woman in Iraq is better off now that the statue of Saddam Hussein have been toppled and he is awaiting prosecution, in many, many ways the situation has worsened for Iraqi women. First of all, 100,000 civilians have been killed there. And I think perhaps some of you know this, but the figure sort of requires at least a little bit of explanation. Because our military is famous for saying, well, we don't do body counts. We're not responsible for quantifying the loss of human life, of civilian life. So this 100,000 figure comes from a study that was published by the British journal Lancet. And the way that they came up with the figure was that they looked at a small sampling of about 900 households that had been hit by U.S. bombs, by aerial bombardment from American weaponry. And they created a probabilistic projection for the entire Iraqi population. So based on this small sampling in a few different neighborhoods, they came up with 100,000 civilian deaths. And it's not an exact number, it's not a perfect number. There are arguments for making it higher and making it lower, but it really is the best sort of ballpark that we have because of our military's unwillingness to deal with one of the consequences of this war. For those who have survived, for those who aren't dead, the present is unbearable and the future is really bleak. I think it's important because we see the pictures of the veiled women and sort of hierarchical Arab society, I think it's important to step back a little bit because contrary to our assumptions, women in Iraq once enjoyed relative equality, frequently contributing to and benefiting from Iraq's largely secular economy and society. In the 1950s, Iraq was the first Arab country to appoint a female government minister. Women worked freely in banks and in government and administrative departments and were involved in a really vibrant public debate in that country. It was common for Iraqi women to hold public office, and the United Nations ranked Iraq as having the highest level of gender equality throughout the Arab world. Prior to the United States' 2003 invasion, and even after a decade of war with Iran and then the 1991 Gulf War, women still comprised more than 20% of the Iraqi workforce and held a wide range of technical, professional, academic, and government positions. They also made up a full fifth of the country's parliament. And it's interesting to note that here in the United States, women fill about 14% of the seats in Congress. But in the last decade, and to shore up political power in the face of the crippling sanctions and as a new war sort of loomed on the horizon, Saddam Hussein began to make deals with tribal leaders, religious leaders, changing the laws to allow men to take more than one wife, and sanctioning honor killing, something that hadn't been a part of Iraq throughout its sort of throughout its history. And women were compelled and pushed out of public out of the public sphere in Iraq. Now, when the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority came in and took over the administration of Iraq, their rhetoric and their sort of stance would lead you to assume that they made a lot of changes there, but they didn't. They continued this policy of appeasement, of appeasing religious leaders in Iraq. They picked their battles, and they chose not to pick the battle for women's equality. When the CPA moved, they moved to decrease rather than increase the influence of women, filling the parliamentary positions that they had held, filling those positions with men. At the first meeting for post-Ba'athist reconstruction, only 4 out of the 80 representatives of the new government were women. No women were appointed to be governors of all of the 18 provinces of Iraq. And no women were appointed to the committee that would oversee the drafting of the new constitution. In the governing council, women filled 3 of 25 seats, and one was assassinated almost immediately after taking that position. In the elections that we saw recently, there were a few women who ran for positions, but they were really bogged down because of the secrecy and the fear that sort of permeated those elections. And it's not just in the halls of power that women are seeing their rights dwindle, but in the streets as well, and in the markets, and in the universities, and in the in job sites. There's an article in the Christian Science Monitor that reported that Iraqi universities are now implementing dress codes, and mosques are turning away women who are not wearing a veil covering their clothing. There's growing societal pressure on women to cover their hair and to wear the veil. And then on top of that, on top of all of those things, there's the overlay of the ongoing war and occupation. Iraqi and U.S. forces are unable to provide for domestic security. The mission is accomplished, the war is over, and yet violence permeates Iraq. There's a recent Human Rights Watch report that found that that neither Iraqi police forces, which are just being trained, nor U.S. occupying forces, which are sort of the titular security forces while police are being trained, neither of them are dealing well with abductions, with sexual violence, with the kidnapping and sexual slavery that's happening in Iraq. The report found that the U.S. military and the Iraqi police are giving very low priority to allegations of sexual assault and allegations of abductions. And those who attempt to report instances of sexual violence are met with indifference by both U.S. officers and Iraqi police. Meanwhile, Iraqi homes, hospitals, farms, and water treatment plants remain in ruins. And acute malnutrition has doubled, and infectious diseases are on the rise. As those who are the primarily responsible for meeting people's most basic needs, Iraqi women have been forced to intensify their work hauling water, preparing food, and caring for children who are traumatized by bombing, disease, and hunger. For many in the United States, these problems, both of Iraqi women and U.S. service women deployed there, seem really remote, but we don't really have to go all that far away from home to see the impacts of this war on women here in this country. And I think the story of a woman named Nicole Goodwin ties the experience of women soldiers, women in Iraq, and poverty here at home together really well. She was a veteran of the war in Iraq. When she came back home, she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But even as a veteran, there were all sorts of problems with her veterans benefits, and she couldn't pay rent for herself, and she couldn't stay with her mother because their relationship was bad. So she was on the streets of New York City. She was homeless with her one-year-old daughter, and this is in November of last year. She said, "When I first got back, I just really wanted to jump right back into a job. I wanted to forget about Iraq. But the culture shock from the military to civilian world hit me," she says. "I was depressed for months. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. The worst thing wasn't the war. It was coming back, because no one understood why I was the way that I was." And sort of in this fragile sort of psychological and emotional state, she finds herself homeless, going from shelter to shelter, but unable to get public assistance because she had these sort of veterans benefits that were looming on the horizon. Any day she was going to get them, and they kept getting held up again and again. At one point, because her case was publicized, was written up in the newspaper, things looked a lot better for her, and she's now in college and has a stable home, and her daughter and she are doing well, and she's in counseling. But the overall story sort of points to the cost of the war, that the war is costing billions of dollars, and that those billions of dollars are being paid by those who can least afford it, by the poorest and by the most vulnerable and by the children. And if we look at the national budget for next year, we see big increases for war and for weapons manufacturers, and we see cuts everywhere else, mostly for programs that are aimed at alleviating hunger, homelessness, unemployment, and poverty. The Bush administration has requested almost a $420 billion budget for the Department of Defense in fiscal year 2006, which begins in October of this year. That's a $19 billion increase over last year. And it doesn't include the funding for the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons activities, which is usually included in that. The numbers on the DOE's budget haven't been finalized yet. That $420 billion also doesn't include the costs of ongoing military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The cost, as some of you know, of those are paid for out of emergency supplementals that receive little or no scrutiny in Congress. There's this sort of funny thing now with the most recent request that there's millions of dollars to build an embassy in Baghdad. And members of Congress are saying, "Well, I mean, we want the money for the war. Of course, our troops need the war. But explain to me how this embassy is an emergency. Explain why this can't go through the normal process." So far, American taxpayers have ponied up more than $200 billion for the cost of war and occupation since October of 2001, when we launched the invasion on Afghanistan. Right now, Congress is looking at this proposed $80 billion supplemental package. And so together with the $420 that we'll spend on the military for this year, we're looking at almost $500 billion that we'll spend. That means that every day we spend $1.3 billion on the military, and that's $15,000 a second. Just to compare that, we spend about $6,000 per year per child on public education. So we spend less than half what we spend a second per year per child on public education. This spending, this $420 or $500 billion, is totally out of step with the rest of the world. We spend six times as much as Russia, which is the second largest spender. We spend alone what the next 25 nations combined spend on their militaries. And under President Bush, we've seen military spending increase 23%. And again, that's just for the actual Department of Defense budget. That's not including the cost of these wars. While money is slathered on for war, we see shortages everywhere else. Thousands of social programs are being cut, and those cuts disproportionately impact women, because women are disproportionately poor in this country. In 2003, poverty rates grew for the third straight year, and women, again, were much more likely to be poor than men. Almost 60% of the adults who are extremely poor, and that's sort of a measurement which means that people having income of less than half of the poverty standard. 60% of adults who were extremely poor in 2003 were women. So about one out of every 20 women is extremely poor, compared to about one out of every 26 men who is in that same category. There are loads of statistics and data on women in poverty, but I feel like I've already dumped enough sort of data on all of you. Just want to share one last point on that. 90% of the adult welfare recipients in the United States are women. And these payments are woefully inadequate to help women escape poverty and take care of their families. By way of contrast, the weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin each year receives more than $20 billion in contracts. And that's more than what we spend on TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That's more than what we spend on TANF on a yearly basis. So poor women suffer, and Lockheed Martin is again the largest and most powerful and wealthiest weapons manufacturer, making $20 billion in contracts last year. At the War Resisters League, we have this pamphlet that we're in the process of updating that's titled Battered by the Pentagon, and I want to just alert you to that will be, we had hoped to have it out in time for Women's History Month, and it didn't, we got behind. But it will be up on our website in the next couple weeks.